I'm George Flynn. Welcome to InDepth TV. I've got a fantastic guest here today that's going to bring us some fantastic insights also. Tom G., here you are with us. You're CEO, and what is your total title at the Henry County Medical Center?
I guess CEO or Chief Executive Officer of Henry County Medical Center.
And you run the place. You're administrator, CEO.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. We want to know some background about where you grew up, where you were born.
Well, this is my 40th year in healthcare in Tennessee. I started my career here at Methodist Hospitals just across the street back in 1977, and came down here from St. Louis, where I grew up and went to school at the Washington University School of Medicine and Healthcare Administration, and had an opportunity to do my residency here in Memphis, and have stayed in the area ever since. So I went to Henry County Medical Center back in 1992 and had an opportunity to go up there and run that facility, and been there ever since. It's been a great place to work and a great community to be in.
And you've been there since what year?
Since 1992, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I think I'm the second most tenured administrator in Tennessee.
It sounds like it. It sounds like it because, you know, that background. What was your background? What was your major in school?
Well, I actually went to DePaul University in liberal arts. I was a history major, actually, and thought I was going to go into law, and ended up at, following my father in his footsteps. He was an administrator in healthcare in St. Louis, and went back and got my graduate degree there, and then part of our education was to go do a residency, and Methodist is where I did.
You did your residency.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, we really appreciate you being here. Let's talk for a minute about the Affordable Health Care Act and its impact and what it does and what you've seen it do to Henry County and in the medical center there at Henry County.
Well, the Affordable Care Act, I think, you know, as it was unrolled a couple of years ago, three, 4 years ago now, it's had a mixed impact on Tennessee hospitals in particular, but rural hospitals in Tennessee, mainly because it's not really been fully implemented in our state. We had seen some initial activity with the health exchanges as people got on the health exchanges, and it did reduce the number of uninsured in our community and across Tennessee slightly, but didn't have quite the same impact that it had in Kentucky, and we're right near the Kentucky border, and our chief competitor is the Murray Callaway Hospital in Murray, Kentucky, and Kentucky did a full implementation with the expansion of the Medicaid population, and they saw a significant decrease in their uninsured population, so that was a positive for that hospital up there. I think the issues that we've seen is that in Tennessee, we had significant cuts to community hospitals like ourselves in order to help pay for the ACA, very expensive program to implement, and we weren't seeing the benefit of having fully insured people in our community to help make up for those cuts. And so it's been a real drain on the finances of rural hospitals in particular, I think, because we're so dependent on the government payer sources, Medicare and Medicaid, Tennecare in our state, and because we have a high uninsured population as well. About 18% of Henry Countyans were uninsured prior to the ACA, it's down to about 10 or 11% now. But so it's still a significant
So it went from 18 down to about 10 or 11.
11, right. So it did have some improvement there. But again, the cuts to our medical center, for example, are approximately $38 million over a 10-year period. So almost $3 million a year is being cut in our Medicare reimbursement principle.
So they were reimbursing at a certain rate or per capita?
We had a we have a market basket increase for Medicare typically year in and year out, and as part of the ACA rollout, they rolled back those market basket increases. And so our average increase for Medicare in the last 3 or 4 years has been less than 0.5% increase a year, yet we have a 5, 6, 7% increase in healthcare costs for drugs and salaries and everything.
Personnel, I mean, you know.
A huge problem.
Right. And medications, like you say.
Absolutely. So drug costs, and a really big issue a lot of people don't understand is the impact of trying to keep physicians and nurses in a rural community. We have to compete with Memphis and Nashville for those resources, and we're having to step up as a hospital now and employ a lot of our physicians to keep them in the community, because their reimbursements have been cut so severely that they are leaving the community, or at least coming to us and saying, if you don't help us, you know, financially, mm-hmm. then we're going to have to leave and go someplace where we can make a better living. So our biggest cost problem right now is employing doctors and nurses and keeping up with the salary costs.
Where do you find the funds to be able to do that?
We don't. We've been burning through our capital reserves at a pretty significant rate. Our hospital will lose about $3 million this year on a total business of about $80 million. And as a result of that, we have some reserves that we use for capital equipment purchases and things like that. In a good year, you don't have to dip into those reserves because you have income coming in. But in these last 2-3 years, we've seen going from about a $3 million profit 3 years ago to a break even 2 years ago to break, you know, a little bit of a loss last year. Now we're going to have a significant loss this year. So it's a deteriorating situation that's a problem for us. So we've got about one more year left of our capital reserves, and then we're going to be in a point where we can't buy equipment, improve our buildings and things like that.
What you know, you being, you know, both the administrator and CEO, what kind of plan do you have? What do you see in the future for this?
You know, we're hopeful. We're working with the American Hospital Association and others to try to get some attention to rural hospitals in particular, because we kind of have some unique pressures that maybe urban hospitals don't have. We're in a safety net situation in our communities to provide essential healthcare services, and we need some assistance in tweaking some of those programs that maybe could keep us viable in the community. We're hoping that we can get some improvement. For Tennessee in particular, we're way underpaid for our area wage index under mm-hmm. Medicare, and we think that if some of that was just tweaked, that would help us significantly. If we could do something with drug pricing to allow rural hospitals to have 340B pricing, which is a program that allows discounted drug prices for people that mm-hmm. can't afford their drugs, and some other things like that, we'll be trying to deal with that. Otherwise, we're going to be forced to cut services or cut positions, other things, cost savings ideas that we would have to implement in order to stay viable.
And no patients want to see that. No, no. Doctors want to see it. The general public, the hospital right. employees, nobody wants to see that. There are two basic things that could happen with the ACA. What would you like to discuss, both of those paths?
I think there's, you know, a couple different options that are legislators and congressmen, everybody are going to be dealing with. One is, just do we do a total repeal and go back to what we had prior to that? That's an option. I think a lot of hospitals and providers are concerned about that, because what's the impact of putting a bunch of people off of their insurance and back into the uninsured situation, and does that exacerbate our problems in the short term if they reduced all the reductions in Medicare reimbursement stuff? We might actually see a benefit for a brief period of time as we would see our reimbursements increase, but it wouldn't deal with the problem of the uninsured and the high charity levels that we have in our community. We provide about $7 million in charity a year for our community. So that's, you know, one option. It would, in the short term, it might give a little bit of relief while they tried to
So that's completely repeal.
That's completely repealing.
And not do anything, go back to where we were, but go back to square one and then come forward again.
Right, and that's one option. Another option is to go ahead and repeal and replace with something immediately. I think that's the preferred situation, because of the keeping people with insurance and access to insurance, and that would certainly help the hospitals. But again, that doesn't necessarily provide relief for the hospitals like ourselves, where we haven't expanded the Medicaid population or increased access. You know, will we continue to have those decreases without getting some relief from the insured population? I guess another option would be that they would, you know, repeal and then spend 2 or 3 years trying to come up with a replacement plan, and that could work. again, there's going to be that period of time where I don't think rural hospitals have a lot of time to sit right. there and wait for, and I think that would be a concern if there was
but
some
like
relief
you said,
for rural hospitals in the interim, yeah, we'd be okay with that.
In a year and a half, you're out of money.
We're in big trouble.
So you're in trouble there. So you would like to see something done more rapidly.
Repeal and replace makes sense. I think there are issues with the ACA that need to be resolved. But the basic plan has a lot of merits to it. It's just how do you deal with some of the issues around the individual mandates and things like that that could be tweaked and potentially resolved. We're hopeful that they'll do
something. The different facets of the ACA or a plan to replace it, which parts of it would you like to see kept? And which parts of it would you like to see totally scrapped, and which parts would you like to see modified?
Well, I think the things that everybody wants to keep are universal. We all want to have no pre-existing conditions.
You could be insured if you have had a heart attack or have had cancer or had...
Right, or if you're a female that's pregnant, I mean, many of those people were excluded from their health insurance before that, so you would be covered. You'd also have the ability of your children to stay on the plan longer through age 26. That's been a very popular feature. So those are the big things that people like. There's the things that people don't like are the individual mandates, the taxes, and some of the other costs associated with that. And those are kind of critical to financing it, because these costs of having people on the insurance and with no pre-existing conditions, that's very expensive, and you've got to have a way to pay for that. And the real issue to me is a insurance actuarial issue. It's how do you spread risk over a large population?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if you don't have everybody in the game, then you are running the risk of having just the sick people on the plans, and the healthy people that would be paying premiums are not there, and so you have this real issue of financing. So, I think there needs to be some incentive or some way to get people into the program. Now, whether you make that a mandate or whether you give them good incentives, that could work. Like the idea of some proposals for HSAs, health savings accounts, where people would have a little more personal responsibility as a patient to save money and use those funds to make good decisions when they buy health care. That could be a good thing. But then how do you get people to do that? We have issues today with our retirement system where people have a 401k or whatever, but they don't put their money in it,
right,
even though it's beneficial to them. And how do you get them to participate? They start thinking about it when they're 45 or 50, and it's a little late to start saving for retirement. Now, I'm afraid that will happen with HSA. So, we've got to have good incentives, and that can be very costly to the government or others to try to deal with that. I think from a hospital's perspective, what we want to see is access to care, that we have universal coverage, not necessarily government-run care,
right,
but universal coverage where everybody has access to at least basic health services.
Well, as a consumer, I could see where somebody would say, well, I'm not going to buy it until I get sick.
Right.
But when I get sick, I know I've got no pre-existing, so I can go ahead and buy it then.
Right.
Could it be structured something like the life insurance industry, where the sooner you buy it, the less the price, and then it graduates?
That would be a way to do it. Maybe that you got to have enough incentive to make them realize, well, if I wait too long, it's going to cost me a lot more. I think that works in the long-term care insurance industry somewhat. If you wait till you're 65 or 70 to buy your long-term care, it's going to be almost prohibitively too costly. So will that work? I think it could, potentially.
What about insurance companies selling across state lines? Because what we have right now is a mandate that you have to have insurance.
Right.
And very few companies in there, so basically you have a monopoly.
Sure.
And then what happens is rates go up.
Absolutely.
Deductibles go up, and you've got a problem.
Yeah. I think what's missing from that discussion, I think it's great if you could go be more competitive in the insurance market. That would be a good thing, because being able to buy across state lines could potentially reduce or keep premiums down to a point. But I think there's a bigger issue there in terms of how insurance works from state to state. Most of the big insurers probably would not have one insurance product for the entire nation or for big sections of the country because of the concerns about adverse selection of the types of patients.
Right.
In other words, if I were in Tennessee where we have a pretty poor health status, and I wanted to go to North Dakota or Utah where they have a really high healthy population, is the insurance company in Utah going to sell me insurance knowing that I might be a more of a risk as a patient and cost them more money and then ultimately raise the premium cost to the Utah citizen? So I think there's some problems with that argument that that's a big solution to the problem. I think it can help, but it's not the big panacea that a lot of people think it would be.
Well, as you said, the Affordable Health Care Act, the grand idea was pretty good, but the details, the devil's in the details, and it just hasn't quite worked. What parts of it or what parts of government do you see that are going correct? What is government doing that's right?
Well, in terms of the ACA, I think the initial idea of having a market-based system that uses the private insurance market was good, and the basic structure of trying to have everybody in the program. Many of the health exchanges that were set up were done very well, and there are states where the premiums have actually gone down. And so where the states really developed that and pursued that, that has worked pretty well. I think the basic plan is a fairly conservative plan. It's not government-run insurance. It's not like we saw with Hillary Care or with a Medicare type program or a public option was taken out of it so that there would be a more of a personal responsibility to try to buy insurance. I think that was good. But I think it was so complicated of a bill to implement, and it was kind of pushed through so quickly that they missed a lot. They maybe went a bridge too far in terms of trying to make it go in smoothly.
Well, yes. And so it was just rushed through there. What do you see that government is doing that is not so well done, and what can we do to improve mm-hmm. that? Anything you want to talk about?
Yeah, I think...
I know you're focused on healthcare, so am I.
Right. Well, I think if we're still talking about the ACA, the way that the Medicaid issue was handled was unfortunate. I think we piecemealed part of the program. We have 19 states that did not expand the Medicaid population, and that's creating a system of haves and have-nots. We have states that have embraced that and have done very well financially and are making impacts on their healthcare system, but then a lot of the southeastern United States is not doing very well because of that. So I think that's a major failure of the system.
From a hospital standpoint, should we have expanded or should we expand Medicaid? Yeah.
I think we should have in Tennessee. That was a missed opportunity. We've gone, two or three years, several billion of dollars of federal funds could have come into the state and helped provide more of our people in Tennessee with insurance. Now we are looking at a different way of funding Medicaid. The federal government wants to look at block grants and those types of ways of funding that. And does that put a state like Tennessee at a disadvantage because we did not accept the funds 2-3 years ago? And states like California, Massachusetts will get a bigger block potentially than a state like Tennessee would get unless there's something done to mitigate that and make it more fair for the states. Hopefully that is going to happen because states like Tennessee have had a very efficiently run TennCare program and they shouldn't be penalized for having done that efficiently.
If we did expand Medicaid or TennCare, if we did expand it, most people say, well, what's the problem with doing that? Why was there a pushback to not expand that?
Well, I think there was a concern from our legislature that if we did expand, took that money, we would put a lot of people on insurance, and we might be faced a few years from now of having to take those people off if the federal government did not continue to fund we're going to fund 90 to 100% of that funding was going to come from the federal government. But if that went away, then we'd be faced with a situation we had a few years ago with 10 care, where we had to take several hundred thousand people off of the 10 care rolls, and that was really a negative situation for the state and for the legislature. So I think they were reluctant to take those funds, not knowing what the long-term prospect of that was. But
the other answer would be a state income tax.
Yeah, well, or you'd have to come up with some major funding source for the state to continue to provide it. One of the positive things in Tennessee is the hospitals have actually footed a lot of the bills for the Medicaid program by funding through matching funds that hospitals have put up money to match funds from the federal government, and they get their money back typically in the long term by doing that. So that's helped tremendously in our state. If we did not have those matching funds, we'd have a severe
budget situation. You went over one point. How do they get their money back, you say?
Well,
or is that a gamble?
Well, under Medicaid, standard Medicaid, there's about a two to one match. So if you put in, $30, you get $60 back, and then from the federal government, and so you can help fund that 30% of the money that comes back from the federal government. Under the ACA, though, this was a 100% match for the first 3 years, and then it drops down to 90% after another 3 to 5 years, I guess. So you'd still have a pretty high match from the feds.
Well, we're always looking at cost, and we see egregious drug company costs going up. Has it affected the hospital also? Your costs are the same as everybody else.
Yes. Right? Yeah. I mean, that's one of our biggest impact in what we called our controllable costs, our supply costs when we provide patient care. Our biggest out of control cost is our drug costs, and that's a problem when we're trying to provide chemotherapy services, for example, in a community where there are no access to those kinds of services. The cost of chemotherapy drugs is astronomical, yet the reimbursement from our payer sources is below cost, and so we can't even hope to provide that cost without some service, without some relief.
Right. And we'll just take, for example, the cost of an EpiPen.
Mm-hmm.
They went from one cost to a dramatic increase. And they used to have two EpiPens in the box, and now they only have one.
Right.
And didn't they go to $600 or something?
Yeah, they were over that. I think they were up to $1,500.
$1,500?
And so now they come back with a generic one that's a little bit cheaper, but it's still several times more than what an EpiPen would have cost before.
Does that industry have any plan to assist? Because if we go under, they go under.
Sure. And there's a lot of programs through the drug companies now because of the pressure that's been put on them to at least assist people that don't have access or don't have insurance or don't have the resources to buy those drugs. So there are some programs, and we actually have two full-time nurses in our hospital that do nothing but call insurance or drug companies to try to get drugs for patients.
And that's another cost to the hospital.
Absolutely. Again, we have all kinds of nurses and people that aren't doing patient care bedside. They're doing talking to insurance companies and trying to get different services for our patients otherwise, and dealing with patients when they leave the hospital and getting them sure they get to their doctor's appointments and getting
the
their medication so they don't come back in the hospital and again incur more costs. So that's a little known cost that we have that we don't get any reimbursement.
Well, when they come back into the hospital within a certain amount of time, the government doesn't pay.
No, they don't, and they will. In fact, they penalize us, and 3/4 of the hospitals out there, ours included, gets a penalty for readmissions to the hospital within 30 days. And it's in our situation, it's a real problem because we're in a community that has a lot of psychosocial issues around the families and caregivers for these people. And we don't control that, but we're being held responsible for it. So if a patient goes home and decides they don't want to take their medicine or they can't afford their medicine, but they come back to the hospital as a result, then we get dinged for it. Or if they go out and have a car accident, we get dinged for it.
You do.
It doesn't matter what they come back in for in that 30 days that we get the
Well, let's go back. You and I both have a long history, starting in the 70s, coming. What went wrong with healthcare? Because it was working fine in the 70s, wasn't it?
Well, it was, but I'll remember my graduate school, my first first paper I was asked to write was about, is healthcare a right, and or is it a privilege? And then we, I think the second paper was about Ted Kennedy's plans for some kind of a Medicare for all type of program. So we've been talking about this for quite a while, and we were talking then about the impact on the gross domestic product in our in our country was being about 10 or 11% back then. Now it's 19%. And what we're seeing today is the payers, the employers, can no longer be competitive in a global market with the high healthcare costs that we have in this country. And so they are balking now at covering all of the duplication and waste in our system and putting that back on providers and the government and saying, no more, we can't afford to do this. If you look at the cost of a car, $2,500, that cost is probably for the health benefits of the General Motors or Ford. You go to China and they spend about $12, on their health insurance. So we're at a global disadvantage trying to compete because we spend so much on healthcare. And so we've never really stepped up the plate and made the changes that we need to change the way we do care from a what we call a volume-based system of many, many more procedures to do, the more money you generate, the that drives the system, but it really isn't creating the outcomes that we need to have in terms of mortality rates and dealing with chronic disease and length of life that a lot of other countries are able to achieve with for a lot less cost. So it is a fundamental restructuring that needs to occur, and it should have occurred 10, 20 years ago, and we've just never really had the long-term vision to try to make that happen.
But yes, we would talk about it, but we thought this will never happen.
Right. Or we, kick the can down the road, or we wait and say it'll get better, or we can live with this a while longer, because it is going to take some hard decisions. We spend more on the last year of life for care in our country than any other country in the world. We spend 25% of the Medicare program is spent in the last year of life. Not saying that we need to have death panels and other decision making, but we do a lot of things for people that probably are not resulting in any outcome. And they're a result of dealing with emergency care as opposed to trying to mitigate the need for those services earlier in people's lives. And so orientation.
and a lot of people utilize your emergency room as their
primary care.
That's the most expensive care that you can have.
Absolutely. And that's, I think that's a point that people don't think about. We still, in this country, I think sometimes think it's healthcare is a privilege, but it is. We've made it legislatively a right that any person can come to an emergency room and get care regardless of their ability to pay. And we have had that for many years. But it's the most expensive way you can get care, and to come have a $7,000 or $8,000 bill for a fairly minor health issue when you could have gone to your primary care doctor, and if we had built a better primary care system that could have adequately taken care of people quickly, there wouldn't be a need for them to come to the emergency room. And so we really got to change that orientation.
Well, and like you say, we're losing physicians, and therefore, if you don't have physicians, then they just go to the emergency room and.
Right.
They don't even have to show an insurance card. They say, I'm here, I'm sick,
right.
Take care of me.
Right. And that's a problem we have in our community. We have more patients than we have doctors to take care of them. So what are the patients that they typically don't want to have? Oh, those are the ones that are uninsured, the ones that maybe are 10 care patients that just don't pay them adequately. And so those people start to fall through the cracks and end up coming to the hospital, or what we're finding is we're having to employ doctors so we can get those patients into the
right.
System.
Well, Tom G., thank you very much for being here. Thank you for explaining the challenges of rural hospitals. I'm George Flynn. You've been watching In-Depth TV. We'll see you next time.